This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Berlin. Coming up, holiday shopping is over, but we can still help the environment as we buy things. E-commerce is here to stay. But how do you shop green over the internet? There are e-scams and green scams, as well as ways to do it right. Bobby Kennedy has launched a bottled water company that will return all profits to the Riverkeeper movement. Both the Weather Service and the Old Farmer's Almanac say this winter will be a mild one. And on the Earth calendar, strawberries are being picked in Florida. It's part of the Great American Harvest. These stories and more coming up on the Environment Show. You're listening to the Environment Show, and I'm Peter Berlin. As the past holiday shopping season illustrated, e-commerce continues to grow by leaps and bounds. With a few clicks of a mouse and little information about your credit card, you can purchase that towel made from organically grown cotton that you've always wanted. But for those of us who want to buy products that don't harm the environment, how do we know that what we are buying is indeed environmentally friendly? Leah Fleming reports on what e-shoppers who want to buy green should look for.
As I unwrap my noontime indulgence of a Big Mac and fries, I sit back and surf the web, and I'm greeted with phrases like earth-friendly gifts and products for the home, garden, and office, earth-friendly products made from renewable, plant-based, natural ingredients. Visit our website. These are just a few of the advertisements designed to entice people to log on and buy green. But while it may sound easy enough to sign on and order anything from water filters to games for kids to candles and incense, what guarantees do we have that the products that arrive on our doorstep are indeed green?
Green is a relative term, first of all.
Carolyn Nunley is a senior project leader for Consumers Union in White Plains, New York. Consumers Union publishes the popular consumer guide, Consumer Reports.
Everything has an impact of some sort or another at various points through its life cycle. I mean, products take energy to make, they take energy to be shipped places, and of course the materials that they're made from, and then what happens to them at the end of their useful life has impacts. There are also impacts as they're used, if they use energy, water, as consumers use them. So throughout the life cycle, every product has some kind of impact on the environment. So the question isn't so much, is this product green or not? It's what's green about the product, or how is it greener than other products?
Nunley says the green claims companies make can range. They can relate to the product itself being green, or a green claim could simply mean that the proceeds of a sale go to an environmental group. So make sure you are clear in what a manufacturer means when they say green or environmentally friendly.
Do I really need this?
Nunley says before you log on and shop, that's the most important question you should ask yourself.
Is buying a product the best way to meet this need? Is there some other less material or energy intensive way to meet this need? Can I buy a service rather than a product, for example? And the other thing to think about is, does the product perform well? It's no more environmentally friendly in many cases if you have to use twice as much of a product, say a paint, if the paint doesn't cover well and you have to use twice as much of a quote environmentally friendly paint than a conventional paint, you're using twice as much of the product, and it can sort of counterbalance the environmental savings that you get from the product itself.
To get a feel for how buying environmentally friendly products online works, I visited EcoMall at www.ecomall.com, which boasts itself as the largest environmental site on the internet. Tom Kay is founder of EcoMall. He says when you log on, you can buy from 54 different categories of earth-friendly products, everything from energy-efficient light bulbs to organic clothing and food. Kay says there are two ways a consumer can shop at EcoMall.
The first way they would shop around is that they would go to the category of interest and then go down the category, and it would be links to various other websites that carry and sell the products. The second way is there's a search engine on every page on the site, and you can type in any word, and it will search all the articles that we have in ecomall.com/greenshopping, which is our green shopping magazine. And all our various advertisers write articles to educate the consumers, and any word in any of the articles would come up and then lead, and any other articles that have the same word, and lead to the various other websites.
Kay says he understands an online consumer's hesitancy in buying, but there are ways to protect yourself.
So anytime you order anything, you can always return it. That's the law. So if you're not happy with it, you can return it. Secondly, we very much try to have a humanistic understanding of the various companies that advertise with us. We do our homework. We get to know how they get started. We sometimes do research and find out, is this an environmentally correct company? I.e., if a company wants to be in our clothing section and they only sell regular cotton and they don't sell organic cotton or hemp, they might not be acceptable because a lot of pesticides are used in growing regular cotton, and it's very pesticide friendly, even though it's better than poly cotton, and you always have to look for the best alternative in every given area.
Perhaps the best way to shop at these sites is to look past flashy, politically correct jargon and make sure we understand what the manufacturer is telling us about the product, what makes it more environmentally friendly, and who backs up their claims. That's according to Carolyn Nunley.
Is it the manufacturer's claim, or is there some independent third party that will verify the information? There are a couple of organizations, Green Seal and Green Cross being two of them, that certify environmental information about products. Green Seal, for example, develops a set of criteria for various product categories that relate to the environmental impacts of those products and look at various products on the market to see which ones meet those criteria.
So as electronic commerce continues to find its place in the marketplace, both Nunley and Kay say it will become even more important to read between the lines. Nunley says Consumers Union is beginning a project where they'll take a look at green claims by companies and then develop an online encyclopedia. Reporting for The Environment Show, I'm Leah Fleming.
In future programs, we'll report on other environmental consequences of e-commerce. Will it be a plus by limiting the expansion of new shopping malls? Or will it increase air pollution and traffic as individual purchases are delivered by truck? Stay tuned.
Well, you better get it straight. I'm a big-time shopping man. Yeah, I shop real fast. I buy things that don't last. I pay for stuff that I could get for free. And I'll do it till I die, because I've figured out that life is just one big shopping spree. Baby, come on. There's a whole lot of shopping going on.
Good for you and the environment. Every American has the right to crystal clean drinking water from a public water supply. All of our profits will be used to protect and restore America's waterways. Those words are inscribed on the blue Tiffany-designed label of Keeper Springs bottled water. The product is being produced and marketed by a venture founded by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Chris Bartle, and John Hoving. Bobby Kennedy describes how the venture got started in April 1999.
We launched a bottled water called Keeper Springs, and the point of distinction with that bottled water is that 100% of the profits go back to benefit the keeper movement, the licensed River Sound and Bay keepers who are now patrolling and protecting waterways across North America. The original keeper was started by a coalition of commercial and recreational fishermen who began patrolling the Hudson River in 1966, tracking down polluters and bringing them to court. And it was started by a blue-collar coalition of commercial and recreational fishermen in a little village, fishing village called Crotonville, New York. Most of them were former Marines who got together in an American Legion Hall in March of 1966 to talk about blowing up pipes on the river. And they instead decided to work within the law, and they were very successful in helping to clean up the Hudson River, which today is an international success story and the richest water body in the North Atlantic. The miraculous resurrection of the Hudson has inspired the creation now of keepers on 41 waterways, actually, across North America.
As an environmentalist, Kennedy says bottled water has not always been an easy sell.
A lot of environmentalists have been concerned about the growth of the bottled water industry, that it would distract people's attention from the need to protect public waterways. And we saw this launch as an opportunity to not only recapture some of the revenues that are mainly going to foreign companies from selling American water, but also to educate consumers. Each label tells people, you know, you can drink bottled water, but don't turn your back on protecting public waterways.
Kennedy is optimistic about the future of his company because of shifting attitudes about bottled water.
It was always, I think, a source of pride for Americans when we went to Europe or to Latin America or Africa, Asia, really any continent in the world where people commonly bought bottled water, that you didn't have to do it in our country. The waterways were owned by the public, they were being used by the public, and everybody drank out of their tap, and nobody would dream of buying bottled water. But for a number of reasons, some of them good reasons and some of them not so good, bottled water is a trend now in the United States. 50% of Americans now drink it some of the time. 30% of us drink it as their primary source of water. So, and you know, one of the reasons is that it's convenient, it's trendy. The other reasons are that people are genuinely concerned about what's in the public waterways.
Kennedy acknowledges that there are many brands of water on the market, which makes selling a particular brand particularly challenging.
Most people, the fact is, cannot distinguish them. So you have to give them a reason to buy your water rather than another water. And one of those reasons is that people select by is price. Another is the appearance of the label, the perception that there's some prestige attached to it. And we're betting that people will buy our water because it's priced roughly the same as the other waters out there, but that 100% of the profits come back to the environment.
Drawing water itself can have an environmental impact, and Chris Bartle, CEO of the enterprise, is confident that the Keeper Springs operation is environmentally sustainable. The water comes from a spring in the vicinity of Utica, New York.
The spring is a high-capacity source. It has positive outflow at up to 500,000 gallons a day, and we're not drawing even a tenth of that. We could supply quite a high percentage of the New England bottled water market and not even come close to that.
The water is pumped from a spring about a half a mile uphill where it is ozonated and bottled. Currently, Keeper Springs water is on the shelf in major retail outlets in the New York metropolitan region. But Chris Bartle says the plan is to go nationwide.
Ultimately, what we'd like to see, Peter, is we'd like to see the brand become a national brand with local sources and the profits from each area going back into that area's environmental groups. That's the way we would like to see the brand develop. That's the pitch we'd like to make to each local community. And one of our primary purposes for being is to give people a sense that they can, you know, with a simple purchase of a bottled water, invest in their community's well-being.
Kennedy and Bartle say they're getting a good deal of encouragement and advice from Paul Newman, who started producing and marketing his own brand of salad dressing some years ago, with all profits going to charity. If Kennedy's Keeper Springs water takes off as a business venture, American consumers will be able to boast that the more they drink, the cleaner the water gets. We welcome another affiliate to the Environment Show family. It's WEIU-FM at Eastern Illinois University in Charleston, Illinois. The Environment Show is a national production. It's made possible by the W. Walton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. We're always anxious to hear what you have to say. You can contact us by email at green@wamc.org That's green@wamc.org or by phone 1-888-49-GREEN. Winter is officially here, and climate forecasters are predicting a relatively mild winter across much of the continental United States. And while the U.S. Weather Service never likes us to mention the Old Farmer's Almanac, predictions of both institutions for the first winter of the new millennium are quite similar. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott has more on what we can expect.
According to the National Centers for Environmental Prediction, the Pacific Northwest will experience the most severe weather conditions in the continental U.S. this winter. Dr. Louis Ussolini is director of the department, which is part of the National Weather Service.
Well, the National Weather Service winter forecast for the United States this year has a major storm track affecting the Northwest with above normal precipitation and about average temperatures. But we're looking at a situation developing for this winter that's similar to last year, where there were record rainfall and snowfalls in the Pacific Northwest. In California, we're also looking for above-normal precip with below-normal temperatures.
Dr. Ussolini says La Niña, the cold weather phenomenon in the Pacific, will play a big role in bringing stormy weather to the Pacific Northwest. That's because La Niña shifts the Pacific jet stream north, which directs stormy weather toward that region. For the southern third of the country, from New Mexico to Florida, Ussolini says it will be dry and a little warmer this year.
In the northern Midwest, we expect below normal temperatures, or to near normal temperatures, but above normal precip will be confined to the, the Wisconsin, Michigan area of the upper Midwest. Again, the temperatures will be about average there. As we move northeastward, we expect more variable conditions, and in fact, the certainty of our forecast decreases as we move into the northeast. But right now, we're expecting temperatures to be variable, perhaps slightly above, and precipitation to be average for the mid-Atlantic states up to the northeast.
Dr. Ussolini says it's important for people to remember that when the National Weather Service makes its long-term weather forecasts, they are general regional predictions, which means variations such as storms or mild conditions could occur. The Old Farmer's Almanac is also predicting a relatively mild winter across the continental U.S. Managing editor Susan Peary says while November and December were mild, January will bring colder temperatures to many parts of the country.
Another kind of maybe warming swing in the east in February and March, but cold weather in the west during those months. We're looking for a lot of snow in northern New England, in the Great Lakes, in the Pacific Northwest, and out in the Rockies. So a lot of the ski areas of the country, we think, starting pretty soon, will start to get a lot of snow. In many other areas, the snowfall and precipitation for the winter will be below normal.
Susan Peary says the almanac is predicting some heavy snowstorms for the Rocky Mountains this March. She describes what southern residents may see this winter.
The southern states are going to start out a little bit cooler. Everybody's always really interested, for instance, in the our forecast for Florida. And we're actually calling for cool or average temperatures down there almost every month until about April, when we say it's going to start getting unusually warm.
As for the Great Plains, the almanac says the coldest periods will occur in late January, early February, and mid-March. The best chance for snows in the plains is late January, mid-February, and mid-March. Susan Peary says the almanac uses several factors to make its winter weather predictions, such as solar cycles, historical records and observations, ocean temperatures, and upper weather patterns. Dr. Ussolini says the National Weather Service relies heavily on ocean temperatures, atmospheric observations, and numerical models to make its long-term forecasts. He adds that satellite technology is playing an important role in predicting weather patterns.
both polar orbiting satellites and geostationary satellites, which allow us to measure the important temperature, moisture, and wind fields around the globe. And I think a key aspect of this is that you have to be able to make these measurements around the globe to produce a forecast for any particular region, whether it's the United States or Europe or whatever. You need global observations, and we're relying increasingly on satellite data to make those observations.
You can find more information about the National Weather Service's extended forecast on your personal computer at www.nws.noaa.gov. That's www.nws.noaa.gov. And check out the website for the Old Farmer's Almanac at www.almanac.com. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. As we speak, strawberries are being picked in West Central Florida. It's part of the Great American Harvest. Chip Hinton is Executive Director of the Florida Strawberry Growers Association, based in Plant City, which is located about 23 miles east of Tampa. He says all strawberries are hand-picked.
Well, the strawberries that are grown in Florida can be broken out into two different areas, the day neutral and the early varieties. And most of those berries come from the state of Florida, developed for our unique climate here, and the state of California. Those two varieties account for virtually all of the strawberries in the state of Florida. Now, from that, our predominant local variety is the Sweet Charlie, which developed through our land-grant institution at the University of Florida. Our predominant California variety is the Camarosa.
Strawberries grown outside of Tampa are harvested from around the beginning of November through Easter. Most are marketed to eastern states and the Midwest. Hinton says the growing process begins in September.
We will come in at the end of our summer, and we will actually till in our cover crop, which is used to put as a soil amendment as well as a control for weeds. We will sterilize the soil, bed it, use whatever non-liquid fertilizer that we'll utilize, put down our drip irrigation, put down our plastic. Over a period of 10 days, we'll allow the sterilant to work. Then we'll put our plants in. Each plant is put in by hand. State of Florida, that's roughly 120 million plants, and that starts occurring the last week of September and goes throughout October through the first week of November.
Hinton says strawberry farmers in Florida are using smaller amounts of fungicides and pesticides in the growing process. He attributes this to farmers being more aware of the negative effects chemicals have on the planet and to their rising costs. In addition, Chip says most strawberry farmers in Florida are now using drip irrigation, which reduces the amount of water needed to nourish a crop. Strawberries have been grown commercially for decades in Florida, but Chip Hinton says he has seen the industry expand dramatically in recent years.
Our median-sized farm is 21 acres, and we have about 150 farms here in the state of Florida. It is a small industry in that it's only 6,000 acres, and in fact, you could put the entire acreage for both California and Florida, all the acres of berries grown for the fresh market within the city limits of Plant City. So it's not a big industry from that extent, but it is a very capital-intensive industry. The cash flow on an acre of berries can be $25,000, and you can very easily have $750 million in cash flow from just the industries from California and Florida. Our industry has been in a range of $150 to $160 million, an amount that's tripled in the past 15 years, and we're hoping that we'll be able to double it again in the next 10 years.
Chip's advice to consumers is to look for strawberries that appear shiny, with few, if any, bruises. He says you should refrigerate them when you get them home from the store and be sure only to wash them right before you eat them. As futurists predict scientific advances, which are to come about in the new century, I anticipate the genetically engineered cross between the strawberry plant, wheat, and the cow that bears strawberry shortcake as fruit. Do you suppose it will be a plant or an animal? You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, trees, today and long ago. Chip mills are having a big impact on forests in the Southeast. They devour whole trees and turn them into chips to make wallboard. We talk green about them. Trees 20 to 40 million years ago produced sticky sap which trapped living things which can be found in amber. We meet a scientist who has reconstructed the amber forest. Stay with us. We're talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. Today we're going to be talking about our southeastern forests and chip mills. We're going to hear a lot about them, but basically a chip mill takes a whole tree and turns it into chips. The chips are about the size of a quarter and about twice as thick. They're used for wallboard and paper. Since just about any tree can be chipped, every stick of wood in the forest can be clear-cut and used. And as a result, thousands of acres in the southeast are feeding the mills. The growth of chip mills has been phenomenal. One study identifies 140 mills in the southeast, of which 100 were built since 1985. And any program that results in extensive tree cutting, we know, engenders a lot of controversy. So I've asked two guests to join us who have opposing views about chip mills. They're Dana Smith, Executive Director of the Dogwood Alliance, which is an alliance of environmental groups dedicated to protecting southeastern forests, and an outspoken critic of the chip mill industry. Also with us is Bob Slocum. He's Executive Vice President of the North Carolina Forestry Association. His group represents timber companies, forest owners, chip mill owners, and industries related to forest products. Dana, let's start with you. From your perspective, what are the problems associated with chip mills?
Well, as you said, we have seen a proliferation of chipping facilities spring up across the southeast over the last 10 years. And our concern is that the expansion of this industry has resulted in the expansion of industrial-scale clear-cutting and the replacement of native forests with pine plantations. And we're really concerned because of the potential for negative economic impacts in local communities. We work with a number of local sawmilling operations that are concerned about the clear cutting and the impact that it could have on their business. We work with a number of recreation and tourism businesses who are concerned about the impact of unsightly clear cuts on their economic well-being. We work with local communities, citizens who live in communities where these chip mills have been constructed, and they are concerned about their quality of life and everything from increased logging truck traffic to the noise from the chip mill to the loss of the forest around them that contributes tremendously to their community quality of life.
Okay, well, that's a lot of things, and let's sort of take them one at a time. Bob Slocum, tell us a little bit about the clear-cutting issue, the concern that chip mills have inspired a lot of clear-cutting that would not be taking place under normal logging operations.
I think that probably the first point to make is that chip mills are nothing new. They've been in the South for 100 years. We started making paper in North Carolina in 1906, and we've been turning wood into chips as part of the integrated forest products industry ever since. And so this is nothing new.
Before you move on, has there not been a vast growth in the industry, 100 plants built in 15 years? That sounds like a big expansion.
Oh, there's certainly more chip mills here now across the South than there used to be, and there's several reasons for that, and probably the most notable is that the industry has gone through a structural change, and really what has changed is the point at where wood is turned into chips. It used to be that wood was taken into the pulp mill as logs. And the industry is shifting very rapidly to where the wood comes in as chips. So it's a question really of only changing the point at where wood is chipped. These facilities are out there, and actually it's a more efficient process from the standpoint of the industry and the production of paper and paper products.
But Dana, do you see it that way? Is it just a question of where it's chipped, or is what you see going on in the forests different than what it was before the mills expanded to the extent that they have?
Well, I think there are two responses to that, if I may. One is that there are clear examples of where the industry has expanded production, and in order to feed that expansion, they have constructed new chip mills. The most notable example of that comes to mind when Willamette Industries expanded its production at its Hawesville pulp mill in Kentucky. And to feed that expansion, they set up two chip mills, one in North Carolina and one in Missouri, to feed a chip mill in Kentucky. So the idea that a lot of the shift in the industry, or the reason why chip mills have been constructed, is because pulp mills are simply shifting their production from on-site chipping to off-site chipping doesn't hold true in all cases. The other response to that is, where it does hold true, we have to ask, why is it that the industry is now shifting their chipping from on-site at chip mills, at pulp mills, to off-site locations? And what we've been able to determine based on information that we've looked at from research that's coming out of the North Carolina State University School of Forestry is that forests around pulp mills are experiencing the highest levels of drain on the forest. And so it's much more economical for the industry to transport chips from long distances, which is how far they have to reach now in order to get the supply that's available. It's much more beneficial economically and cheaper for them to set up a chip mill in a distant site.
Let's hear from Bob Slocum on that one. Is that an accurate analysis as you see it?
Well, not entirely, no. Certainly the industry has expanded production. The demand for wood and paper products has increased. We've got more people. They demand more wood products. So certainly production has increased to meet the demand that people have placed on wood products. So certainly when a pulp mill has expanded production, it also needs to expand the amount of wood that it takes in. So that part of it's certainly correct, but and it's certainly true that it's more efficient in many ways in terms of shipping chips and so on. But the notion that all of the forests around chip mills or around the pulp and paper mills has disappeared, and so they've got to go out these huge distances, it's just a pure myth.
Bob, one of the questions that is frequently raised is that since the chip mill can chip just about anything, there is much more clear-cutting than would have gone on if one had more traditional forestry that's designed to produce logs. Is there anything to that? I mean, does that present a different kind of an environmental problem than logging has in the past?
No, I don't think it does, because that particular method, a clear-cut or a regeneration cut, has been going on as long as we've been practicing forestry. It's one of several methods of harvesting timber. And certainly we're going to harvest trees, but from the standpoint of the industry, our goal is trying to make sure that we have forests now and certainly well out into the future. And whether or not there's a chip mill is not going to demand or force one harvest practice over another.
That gets to an interesting issue. We've heard a lot about certified forestry and certified lumber products. Are there chip mills that are operating on a certified basis?
In terms of producing certified chips?
Right, which then produce certified wood products. And for those who are not familiar with this, certification involves an outside source.
And it's still pretty new to the United States, and there's really no generally accepted certification process. The industry is looking at several of these programs, but they're, in terms of producing, quote, certified chips or paper, I'm not aware of any.
Right. Just so we're clear about that, Home Depot has just said that they're going to be working towards certified lumber, and there are numbers of organizations that are at least internationally now looked at as qualified to certify, but that's a different issue.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to hear a little bit from you, Dana, about some of the trade-offs from an economic point of view that you were referring to, i.e. tourism versus milling.
We, as I said, work with a number of local sawmillers across the region who are concerned that because chip mills can take trees that are relatively small diameter in size, that they are, in effect, chipping up the future saw timber of tomorrow, because these are local mills that depend on more mature trees for their survival. And these mills tend to use select logging as opposed to clear cutting, and they tend to employ a lot more people per unit of, or per, you know, unit of wood harvested than does the chipping industry. Chip mills typically only employ about 6 to 8 people directly, and so they're not economically beneficial to the local communities where they operate, and could have the potential to offset any positive economic impacts by the negatives that they pose to local sawmills. And as I said earlier, we work with a lot of recreation and tourism industries. The American Camping Association is now joining the Dogwood Alliance in calling for a moratorium on chip mill permits in the southeastern region. Tourism industries, we've got tourism industries that also are calling with us for a moratorium on new chip mill permits, because they believe that the negative impacts to the visual beauty of the landscape would far outweigh any positive economic benefit that the timber industry could provide. And at the same time, they could have a serious adverse economic impact on their local tourism and recreation industries.
Bob, a moratorium on future mills sounds like a direct frontal attack. How are you folks responding to that?
The idea of a moratorium, chip mills are no threat to the environment. It makes for a nice myth, but they're no threat to the environment. A moratorium is simply unwarranted. The idea that the industry somehow is split on this issue, again, is simply not true.
Well, let's follow up on the tourism issue. I presume the reason that people in the tourist business don't like clear cuts is that people don't want to take vacations to see clear cuts when they could see a real forest. Is this a legitimate concern that they have, or are these clear cuts taking place in areas where they don't have an impact on the recreational forest user?
Peter, I'm going to speak to North Carolina. The forest products industry in this state is the second largest manufacturing industry in North Carolina, and has been one of the principal industries that built the economy here. Tourism is also an important part of the industry and are an important part of the state's economy, and both have thrived. Tourism continues to increase. The forest products industry has done well, and I am aware of absolutely no data, studies, even antecedental information that shows that there is some kind of adverse trade-off, or because we have a forest products industry, we can't have tourism. So I just, I don't think it's true.
Dana, how do you respond to that?
Yeah, there was a study that just came out of the U.S. Forest Service in August of 1997, and it was called Assessing Economic trade-offs in forest management. And in that study, the Forest Service basically found that forests do not have to be mined, logged, or otherwise extracted to stimulate the development of new jobs, and that there is substantial evidence out there that shows that the contributions that a forest makes, an intact forest makes, to the quality of life in an area can affect the rate of economic growth. And that unsightly clear cuts and a decision on the part of a community to expand industrial forestry does have the potential trade-off in terms of recreation, tourism, and just overall, you know, the ability to attract people to come to an area.
So I guess that's an issue which people will differ on. My understanding is that there's some kind of a study that the Forest Service is now doing that will relate to these
issues. I believe that study was out of the Pacific Northwest, and in fact the Forest Service has acknowledged it's so flawed that they have withdrawn it and pulled it back in internal for internal
review. I was
referring
to a study that was supposed to be going on in the Southeast. Isn't the Forest Service doing a broader one on the whole chip mill situation that was going to be done, I think, in 2001?
No, they're doing an overall forest sustainability study across the South. It is not a chip mill study. It's a look at the overall sustainability issues related to forests across the region, and it is
okay.
Not a chip mill study.
Bob, let me ask you something.
Can I respond
Go
to
ahead.
That really quickly? Because even though it's not billed as a chip mill study, one of the major reasons why the Forest Service and the EPA and Fish and Wildlife are undertaking this regional assessment is because of the concerns that citizens have been raising about chip mills and industrial clear cutting and pine conversion in the South, and it will be an important component of the broader sustainability study.
Okay, Bob, I'd like to ask you something that's still not clear to me, and that is, when it comes to chip milling, does that involve areas which you can harvest for chips and not clear cut, or is most of the input to a chip mill the product of clear cut?
There is, in North Carolina, with the exception of a timber harvest where we're thinning a stand and removing a few trees to open it up for the better trees to grow and produce better products, there aren't any acres that are harvested solely to produce wood for a chip mill. That simply doesn't happen. Economically, it's not even feasible. So there's a chip mill, and the production of chips is part of an integrated industry. And, you know, what goes on is designed to make the highest and best use of the products that are harvested. On any given acre, Peter, you're going to harvest timber, and some of the material is going to go to the sawmill, some may go to a pulp mill or chip mill for paper, and some may go to other manufacturing facilities based on the quality of the wood and what's out there.
And so it's not necessarily a clear cut, is that what I
Not all the time,
saying?
No.
Right.
And in fact, one of the things that has led to, from the standpoint of really health and productivity, is the fact that we haven't had good markets for a lot of this low-quality material, and the harvesting that's gone on over the past has, they call it selective harvesting, but what it is high-grading.
Okay.
We call it take the best and leave the rest
in the
and
moment,
end up with junk.
In the moment that's left, Dana, do you want to comment on whether we're seeing more or less clear-cutting as a result of the growth in the chip mill industry?
Well, we're definitely seeing more clear-cutting. We can document that when we fly over the region and look at what's happening around these chip mills, and it's almost as if you can fly from chip mill to chip mill by following the clear-cuts. The industry admits that the chipping industry is opening up markets for wood that was otherwise not utilized. And so to think that, you know, they would be out there cutting that wood anyway, even though it wouldn't be used without these chip mills, is in our opinion, ridiculous.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you both. And clearly we have not answered any questions, but we've raised a lot for people to think about. My guests have been Dana Smith, who is executive director of the Dogwood Alliance, an environmental group or alliance of environmental groups, and Bob Slocum, executive vice president of the North Carolina Forestry Association. They've both been talking to us from North Carolina. We know you have some views about this issue, so share them with us. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. Thank you. In this electronic age, we still occasionally read the mail that comes from the post office. So you can write us. It's The Environment Show at 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. That's 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. If you saw the movie Jurassic Park, you'll remember the lifelike Tyrannosaurus Rex dinosaur that scientists brought to life by using genetic material. The DNA was fictitiously extracted from a resin or amber that preserved the material for millions of years. While scientists will not be recreating dinosaurs anytime soon, researchers are finding plants and animals that lived millions of years in the past and which have been preserved in amber. Scientists George and Roberta Poignar have recreated a forest which existed in what is now the Dominican Republic 20 to 40 million years ago. They led an international research effort to extract DNA from insects encased in amber, and their research is the focus of a recently published book, The Amber Forest. I spoke with George Poignar about what he found.
The clues that this ancient forest left behind in amber are truly amazing. Not only are the beautifully preserved insects present, but also flowers, even pollen grains we can find, vines, seeds, moss, lichens, liverworts, and mushrooms. Then at the other end of the spectrum, we can find frogs, lizards, feathers, hair, and bones, mammals. In addition, there are interactions between organisms that are generally not found in other types of fossilization, which are present in the Dominican amber.
Now, is that because the amber was sticky when creatures or organisms bumped up against it? How do you capture those interactions?
Many may realize that amber is a fossilized resin. It comes out of the tree on the sap, just as pine sap does today. It comes out, it's very sticky, it's fairly liquid, and it has the ability to capture very delicate organisms and to preserve them in intimate detail. This is because when the organism lands in the sticky material, it perishes very quickly. Maybe it can try to flap its wings a little bit, move its legs, possibly struggle a few millimeters or centimeters along, but then it perishes. So if it's in the act of doing something, mating, for instance, we have a pair of mating lightning bugs illustrated in the book, or if it's carrying a parasite or something else, usually it dies with the parasite still attached in exactly the same form it was when it was living.
Now, take me through this for the next 65 million years. The bug is mating with its partner. Gets stuck in the amber.
Right.
Then what happens after it gets stuck and they both perish?
After they both perish, then there's a process, a chemical process that occurs. The sugars in the resin slowly pull the moisture out of the tissues of the trapped organisms. And at the same time, certain components in the resin enter and fix the tissue. So it's almost like you were fixing them in a preservative, like formaldehyde or alcohol or something. Then, slowly, over a period of time, the resin begins to harden. And it then eventually will drop from the tree, fall to the ground, be covered with debris, and eventually it's washed, all the amber and the debris tends to be washed down into a floodplain or a lower area that may be then carried right into the sea, into a shallow sea. Eventually, the resin becomes hard, and starts to acquire the characteristics that we attribute to real amber.
And what are the largest organisms that one can find in amber as opposed to pieces of them? I noticed your book had beautiful pictures of what looked like entire organisms.
Yes, I think probably some of the vertebrates are the largest, especially the lizards. We have we've recently examined one anolis lizard that stretches 4 inches, is 4 inches long, and that certainly would be the largest. It's the largest organism that I've ever seen in any amber deposit.
I'm sure every scientist who works with amber rues the day that Jurassic Park came out. But I have to ask you, will there be a time where will science be sophisticated enough someday to capture DNA from amber and be able to put that in a living organism?
Well, this is the amber provides a wonderful opportunity to obtain DNA from some of the fossils there, and several laboratories have been successful in doing that. And I think that it holds a wealth of material, and especially plant material and things, and allows you to tap in and to get gene sequences that might be very useful and that could be inserted into the genetic code of modern-day plants.
Is your research with amber ongoing? And if so, what's on your agenda?
Oh, well, yes, we're continuing. We're now looking at some of the amber deposits found in Lebanon. These amber deposits go back to 130 million years, so they definitely overlap with the dinosaurs. Many of the insects there are completely extinct at the generic and family level. And so this is very exciting because it gives some of the first, a number of first appearances of the groups, that insect groups that occur.
That was George Poynar, co-author of The Amber Forest, published by Princeton University Press. By studying amber, he's able to find and document the plants, insects, and animals and ecosystems that vanished millions of years ago. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. If the winters get any warmer, we'll drink more bottled water, which can help the riverkeeper movement. But strawberry pickers and weather forecasters will get stuck in the amber before it's sold on the internet. It's all terribly confusing, and listening to this program again will not clarify a thing. Call 1-800-323-9262 and order show number 523. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Chartok is executive producer, Stephen Westcott is producer, and the show is made possible by the W. Walton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Be good to the Earth, and join us next week for The Environment Show.